Thank you for coming to Natural Resources Subcommittee. Today is February 23rd, and we are going to go ahead and change the order. Is Representative McLean out? You'll see we have a full agenda here today. However, we're going to change the order of things, so I ask everyone to be flexible. The first bill we're going to hear is House Bill 4037, so that we can have Representative McLean testify first. So we'll have LFO Krista here introduce the bill for us, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4037 directs the Oregon Business Development Department to establish a program to provide incentives to owners of photovoltaic energy systems that collect and distribute solar electricity. The systems must be directly connected to an investor-owned or publicly-owned utility. The equipment must have a nameplate capacity between 2 and 10 megawatts, and the Oregon Business Development Department must consult with the Department of Energy before enrolling an applicant to do equipment verification. And the Public Utility Commission must ensure that the costs associated with an investor-owned utility system are recoverable pursuant to state law. The program awards half of a cent per kilowatt hour of solar power generated to qualified participants for 5 years. The program participation ends on the earlier of either a nameplate capacity of 150 megawatts or January 2nd, 2017, and the program sunsets January 2nd, 2023. The maximum payments that we estimate under this program would be $8.22 million during the life of the program. The fiscal impact for the 15-17 biennium, we estimate $951,561, which includes one position at a 0.58 FTE. And then there's also a fiscal impact statement online for the dash A3 amendment, and the A3 amendment provides the appropriation language necessary for the bill.
Okay, thank you, Christo. And nice to see you, Representative McLean. You want to go ahead and give us your testimony, please?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate your indulgence and allowing me to testify right away on House Bill 4037. I come to testify in favor of this bill. I represent District 55 in the legislature, which is the second largest footprint in the state, next to District 60, my neighbor, which goes all the way to Idaho and touches Nevada, California, and the like. So Cliff Bentz and I represent equivalent to over a third of the state, and our area has a lot of sun. So we have the advantage of having ground that is applicable for many solar projects. So I want to emphasize to the committee, which I thank you for hosting me today, solar energy is clean and renewable. This bill would help create local jobs, ensure a clean energy future, and grows Oregon's solar market. The bill supports working-class Oregonians with good jobs and good wages while providing a good for our environment that is market-based. The bill would create 385 full-time jobs during the construction, with 12 ongoing operating and maintenance jobs. Based on the data I've seen, the expected revenue over 30 years is $1.3 to $1.5 billion. Estimated income taxes on these projects, based upon, I'm sure, employees and the other income taxes paid, would be over 30 years, the equivalent to $80 million. The total estimated property taxes paid over the 30-year expected life of this project would be about $1 million a year, and a little over $31 million over the life of the project. I've got a couple of solar projects in my district with more on the way. Renewable energy makes sense, and I would encourage a passing vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McLean. And we also have Representative Bentz. If you would like to come up, please. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Cliff Bentz, District 60, and much of what I was going to say has just been said. Just add a couple of things. First of all, the adoption of the new 50% RPS, which I think is going to happen, is going to drive an enormous amount of investment front-loaded over the next 4 years in this type of power, and it would be crazy for Oregon not to be doing what this bill would suggest, which is an $8 million investment for about a $330 million build-out. So 0.026%, I think, of the cost of driving this thing forward. It's if we don't do it here in Oregon, then we'll enjoy all kinds of solar power generated in Utah brought here, which would be really unfortunate after our ratepayers pay for it. So this is a very, very small investment for a very, very large return. It's huge for my area for a number of other reasons. One is, although some senator, for example, has Hansel has a lot of wind towers in his area, in our area we would be much more enthusiastic about a low-profile power generation, not big, huge towers that tend to change the character of communities and view sheds. So this is a really good thing for an alternative to that. Finally, I believe that the history of the organization that's bringing this forward, Obsidian Resources, is one of doing the investment and driving down the cost, which is exactly what we need to do, because I think some of the elements in the new bill that's coming forth as amended over in the Senate for the RPS compliance is going to demand more refinement in cost, which I'm happy for, and this will help drive those costs down. So very supportive of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunities to testify in support of it.
Thank you, Representative. Oh, excuse me, Senator Hansel.
I want to make sure I got this right. An $8 million state investment, did you say, for a $300 million build-out?
$330 million build-out in total.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Benz? Well, because this is a work session, we are not having additional testimony. I know there are a lot of people here watching this bill along with the other bills. We do have, should we go ahead and talk about the amendment now? Or?
Sure.
Okay. We have a -3 amendment, and we will have LFO describe that, please.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the -3A3 amendment appropriates $951,561 to the Oregon Business Development Department for the biennium beginning July 1, 2015. That's for the costs of staffing a person to oversee the program, as well as beginning payments for the start of the program in the 15-17 biennium.
Okay. Do I have a motion to move the amendment, or we'd like to have a discussion first, or?
If there's no discussion, Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to HB 4037.
Okay, and discussion, objections to the amendment? Okay, then we'll go ahead. The -3 amendment to House Bill 4037 has been adopted. And the measure, as amended, is recommended to be moved to the full committee on Joint Ways and Means. Do I have a motion to move House Bill 4037 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended?
I so move.
Okay. Any discussion, objection? Okay. Motion, we have passed House Bill 4037 amended with the -3 amendment with a due pass recommendation. Okay, we'll close the
full.
No, the carriers are full.
Guess I'm the only one.
Lucky you. Okay, well, you support renewable energy, Senator Hansel, so that should be okay. So we'll go ahead and we'll close the work session on 4037. Congratulations to everyone who came today. That's exciting news. I'd like to see support for renewable energy. So now,
first chamber and second chamber, do
the first chamber, do you want to do those now?
We usually decide, but you can put Representative McLean down. And put some
okay. All right. Okay, well, we'll put, should we say Representative McLean? Okay, we'll have Representative McLean. Or Representative Benz, who do you think?
Either one.
Okay.
In the floor?
No,
the floor.
On the floor.
On the floor.
Well, maybe Representative McLean, since he testified, it would be appropriate for him to carry the bill to the full.
Okay, we'll have Representative McLean, and then on the Senate side.
Yeah, I could do the Senate.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Hansel. So that is settled. And so then let's find out who's where now.
Thank you.
Okay, again, thank you everyone for flexibility. We are going to move back up to the top of the agenda now, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1563. This is relating to on-site septic system financing, and Paul Siebert is going to give us the LFO report.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1563 authorizes the Department of Environmental Quality to award a grant or grants to develop and implement a low-interest loan program for repairing, replacing, and upgrading on-site septic systems and connecting to sewer systems. The bill already contains a $250,000 general fund appropriation that was made by the Senate Environment Committee, so we don't have to adopt any amendments. Of the $250,000, DEQ is to use $200,000, a minimum of $200,000, to make a grant no later than September 1st, 2016, to a third party to operate the loan program. So DEQ will not be operating the loan program. It will not be a state program. DEQ is allowed to use up to $50,000 for the administrative cost of implementing the bill.
Okay.
And the Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending the measure be moved to the full committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Paul. And so do we have any discussion on the bill? Yes.
Do we have anybody testifying?
So, Representative Hack, this is a work session, and so I don't see any members here, unless there's somebody waiting somewhere that I'm unaware of. So I don't think we're going to be hearing testimony today, but I think if there are any questions.
I did have, thank you, Chair. I did have a clarifying question. Can you talk a little bit again about whether it's a loan program or a grant program, because it talks a lot about being a grant program, but yet when you read the bill, it's loans, and who will be running and operating that part of it?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, it is a loan. It is, the money is intended for a loan program. The loan program will not be operated by the department, though. It will be operated by a third party. So the third party will make a proposal to DEQ. DEQ will select who will be getting the amount, and they'll make a grant to that group of a minimum of $200,000 that group will then use to do the loans.
Follow up?
Yes.
There's discretion. So interest rates, whatever they decide for folks, is there some parameters?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, I believe the bill is silent on interest rates, but the intention is it would be a low interest loan, but that would have to be developed through rulemaking.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Questions?
Just to apologize to you, Madam Chair, and the committee, you know what it's like out there right now. I was in another committee testifying rather than helping sustain a quorum in here.
Well, thank you, Representative Gomberg. We just missed you and wanted to have you here, so we're glad you're back. Representative Hack, did you have any other questions? Would you like to have the folks that have been working on the bill come up? Because I'm happy to have them come up. It's no problem.
It's okay.
Yeah, I want to make sure your questions are answered.
Thank you, though.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay, so do I have a motion, Mr. Hansel?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1563 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Hansel. Any discussion? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to say, you know, we heard this at length in the policy committee, and it's really a great example of a public-private partnership, I think, that's being proposed here to meet a really serious need, especially in rural parts of the state. So I fully support this program.
Thank you. I agree. Thank you, Senator Dembrough. Well said. Any other discussion or objections? If not, then we will go ahead and we will accept Senator Hansel's motion to move Senate Bill 1563 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. We need someone to carry it to the full. Representative Gomberg, would you be willing to do that, please?
Especially since I was here for all the presentations and am fully up to speed, I would be happy to carry this one.
That would be fantastic. Thank you. And then...
the sponsor is...
Senator Robles. Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll do the Senate.
Yeah.
We'll have a Senator Roblin do the Senate.
And we're good.
Okay. All right. And I'm going to close the work session on 1563. And then we will move on here to House Bill. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 4113. And relating to the task force on drought emergency response, and Matt Stainer will give us a summary of the bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 4113 establishes a 11 to 15 member task force on drought emergency response. This is a non-legislative task force charged with researching and evaluating potential tools to prepare and respond to drought emergencies. These include identifying options to minimize the impact of the drought. The task force required to submit a report to Interim Legislative Committee on Natural Resources by November 1st of 2016. The report needs to include recommendations for improving communication to raise awareness of drought conditions, as well as efforts to mitigate and adapt to drought conditions. The task force then sunsets at the end of 2016, December 31st. The original bill contained no mechanism for paying for the cost of the task force and the staff support for water resources. So the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends the adoption of the A2 amendment, which provides a $25,000 general fund appropriation to water resources to pay for the task force and to offset a portion of the cost of the staff support. Yes, Mayor Dess.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody have, there's any discussion on this? And do I have a motion to move the dash 2 amendment?
Madam Chair, I move LFO recommendations to adopt the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4113.
Okay, any discussion, any objection? We move to accept to the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 4113, and now we will vote on House Bill 4113 as amended. Any discussion, any objection? Seeing none. House Bill 4113 is passed with the dash 2 amendment to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. So let's see here who Karras. Has been working
Senator
this.
Senator Roblin was on the bill as a sponsor. Maybe he could carry it to
the floor. I don't do the poll, but he can.
What was that?
I'd carry it to the floor later.
Okay. So do you want to have Roblin carry it since.
To the Senate floor?
Or to the. We need somebody to go to the full.
You've got representatives in the full of Hack and Clem.
For the full, on the full?
On the bill, as sponsors.
Yes, she's not a member of the full.
She's not a member.
What about Clem? No.
I would suggest Senator Roblin since he is a member of the full.
Okay,
we'll do Senator Roblin going to the full, and then on the House floor, Representative Hack, and on the Senate floor, Roblin again?
Yep.
Okay.
And just, I want to make sure we've done this parliamentary-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I did not make the motion. You repeated the motion and then
Oh, for that. For the final passage? Okay, well, we can do it again.
Sure that we're okay on that.
Sure, fine. Go ahead. We'll open it up again, a work session on House Bill 4113.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4113 to the full committee with due pass recommendation as amended.
Okay, and so we will go ahead without any discussion, objection. We will pass House Bill 4113 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation as amended. Okay, moving on. Hello. How are you doing?
Good.
All right, then we are going to go ahead and open up a work session. We are missing bill number here. Oh, the report, excuse me. We're going to open the work session to accept the report, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries IT assessment report. And we have Alex. Go ahead.
Chair Taylor, here. Members of the committee, you might remember Senate Bill 5512 from last session was the budget bill for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Within that was a budget note requiring an assessment of the information technology-related operations within the department that was to be jointly done by the department and the Office of the State Chief Information Officer. They are here to report on that. They also are going to report to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, hopefully at some point this session, if not perhaps in May. But they're here to report today on the results of that assessment.
Okay, thank you. And do we have any folks here that want to come up and tell us about what's going on regarding the Geology and Mineral Industries IT assessment report? Please remember to state your name for the record.
Co-Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Avey, Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I'll be presenting a response following the State Office of the CIO's report.
Hello, I'm Alex Pettit, I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. Excellent. And we're happy to be here today to present to y'all the findings of the study that we had done here with in cooperation with Dogami. So a little history real quick. So established in 1937, Dogami is comprised of two programs, the Geological Survey and Services Program and the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. So I'm not going to read the slides out to you, and I'm sure you're very familiar with Dogami. So a little budgetary context and what prompted this report. We've had through the years a fluctuation in the budget, and particularly of the general fund budget contribution, that there's a core level of services that need to be provided for things, one of those things being IT. And one of the problems that Dogami has faced has been in getting to a level where things were sustained, were planned, were core to what the agency required to build and to support the programmatic things that they get through the federal funds and other funds the work that they do. So the background, the budget note specifically, was the department was directed to work with the OSCIO to conduct a comprehensive assessment to include the governance, the organizational structure, inventory current systems, business drivers, operational technical deficiencies, any alternative methods for data exchange, operation and technical requirements for system data and apps, requirements necessary for any recommended changes, and then this report's to be delivered. And so there's a written report that goes along with this. This is just the card deck. Multidisciplinary team from ETS and GEO examined Dogami's business drivers, inventory of IT policies, and analysis of the core business processes. The teams evaluated how these issues and issued findings and recommendations. Really, there's three key concerns: the risk of the loss of data, lack of physical security, and noncompliance with security policies and procedures. So this is out of the report, the current server storage architecture is technologically and maintenance dead end. It cannot be efficiently or economically scaled up any further. A future model will require the agency to redesign both its server and storage architectures in order to implement more efficient storage systems and a deduplication process so that we're not keeping multiple copies of the same stuff online. So one of Dogami's core missions is the collection, analysis, and processing of very large quantities of data. And the agency's primary challenge is to afford to maintain the massive storage and data transfer capabilities that their mission requires. One of those, so there's kind of three things I guess we'd point out: the lack of dedicated resources for IT management, a lack of understanding on how to operate and comply with state purchasing, and an overburdening trying to support the entire stack of IT operations in-house, trying to do a lot of things that could be perhaps done or performed by other folks. So although from the start there were 11 employees who are identified as information services specialists, this is a classification error. The agency has no staff that are in IT management. So that's been part of the problem, is without having a design, without having an architecture, without building something purposefully to meet a need, it's very difficult then to do this catch-as-catch-can, which has been historically what we've struggled with. Primary IT functions are performed by a contractor. IT staffing without IT staffing, developing an IT plan and strategy, maintaining security, managing data storage systems, network communication, infrastructure distribution. So it's been hard for them, is what I'm trying to say. So at the rate they're going to run out of storage for its data sometime in 2017 and can't afford to build and support more current infrastructure. So, and this is just kind of a projection based upon the rate they're going and things they've committed to do and what have you. One of the things that so there's immediate needs, obviously, that have to be addressed. And then longer term, there's things that we need to look at, what we call stratifying the data. You know, what needs to be online, what needs to be nearline, what can be deduplicated, what can be pushed to offline, you know, that we keep it, but we don't necessarily have to have it, you know, full redundancy, fully available, high, what we call high availability storage, you know. So that's the most expensive storage you got is high availability, and then you've got data that you keep that's important, but we don't need it as high availability. It doesn't have to be, you know, tremendously fast, tremendously backed up, all that kind of, because it doesn't change a lot. Base maps, things like that, photographs, stuff that you get picture and you make one backup and it doesn't change. It's not being toyed with all the time. So, you know, trying to go through that process with them, that's more of a long-term type objective. So short-term recommendations work with, so we got short-term recommendations and long-term recommendations. In the short run, working with us on tactical plans and costs, trying to figure out how we're going to get through, you know, and what do we have, what can we bring, what can we work with to get through 2017. Mitigate urgent IT infrastructure issues, evaluate migration of non-core IT services to ETS. Dogami staff work with DAS Procurement on process and procedure for IT contracting and procurement. Review and improve current IT support contracts. Supplement, if possible, to add additional resources. Over the long run, work with us, and long run meaning we're targeting 2017 session. Work with OSCIO to, and ETS to develop a strategic resource plan for 17-19. Work with CFO to develop a policy option package to implement how this is going to work. In its role as the lead of Oregon LIDAR Consortium, should work on sustaining planning and budgeting to support the program's future data storage, processing, and distribution needs. Some key considerations: Dogami should look at externalizing IT services that are not part of the agency's core mission, and Dogami should implement a technology architecture will enable stratified data storage, which I talked about, support long-term business needs, and leverage industry best practice. There's a lot of things we do in IT that are, because Dogami does so many things that are dependent upon data, those are really core to what they do. There are other things that they do, email, unstructured file management, all that kind of, that's not core to what they do, and somebody else can manage that stuff. So, all right, now I'm going to just hush up here and turn the microphone over.
Thank you.
Dogami appreciates the IT assessment just described and the work that it represents. And we're very concerned about the data risks and the issues identified. We're currently working with Enterprise Solutions, Technology Solutions, to resolve the most pressing data risks through offsite backup and recovery, and are in discussions about transferring to ETS non-core operations, as well as obtaining a strategic guidance to address long-term IT solutions and staffing needs. Our staff are incredibly dedicated and creative in finding ways to accomplish their work with limited resources. However, to help resolve the issues identified today, Dogami anticipates approaching the Emergency Board in May to request funding and additional limitation. Finally, Dogami is committed to a strong partnership with the staff of ETS in the Office of the State CIO as we work towards solutions to bring Dogami's IT systems up to standard.
So if I may say one more thing, I would like to say, echoing some of the comments there, that there have been, even though this was not the vocation of many of the folks, the IT stuff, there is and continues to be dedication to finding solutions that work within the budget, within the context, ways that they can meet the needs for their constituents and folks that depend upon Dogami for information for these resources. And as an illustration of that, there's an example in your packet there, you know, where you go into the appendix there, where in the data center room, you know, so this is illustrative of what kinds of things have had to be, you know, put together, kind of a Rube Goldberg, if you will, kind of a, you know, so what you see there is the cooling system that's used used in their day, in where we keep the servers in there. And then the condensation loop goes to the garbage can that fills up with water, and then that's unloaded every week or so as it fills up before it gets too heavy. And again, the point being that this is what, without, when you're not given the resources that you need to have to do something right, you end up having to do something with what you can do, and you come up with solutions that work. And this is a solution that works. This is not, no criticism at all. This is a solution that works for them, and they've been doing this for some time. This is not the state of, that things need to be left in. That we can do better than this is what I'm trying to say. But it is credit to their staff for finding ways to make it work with the resources that they have. That's really what I'm trying to illustrate here. So, and with that, I'll open for questions.
Representative Parrish.
Appreciate the graphic. Is there a reason why we're not operating our servers in the cloud, why we're still managing data, you know, warehousing internally? I mean, is there a logistical reason that you are managing servers and that you can't outsource your servers to somewhere that is not this setup that actually, I mean, I would actually worry about this setup from just a lot of reasons, that it's sort of jimmy-rigged and, you know, catch fire or something. I mean, it's, so is there a reason why we can't, or why Dogami's not looking at more like servers that are out in the cloud somewhere, and you're managing data center stuff yourself?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, thank you for the question. The direct answer is, as we do the analysis of what it is, we do actually have a partner that we work with. It's called, they used to be called Easy Street. They're now called, they've changed their name. They're a Portland-based company. They have data center floor that we do use. It's an extension to what we do, and they are our cloud service provider, however you want to call it. One of the presentations I made was on an initiative we call Basecamp, where we're going to try to expand that and look for more providers. So we are doing that today, is the direct answer to the question. Insofar as the analysis of Dogami is concerned, there are things that they do that are absolutely core to what they do. And so response time, things that they're keeping, information that they keep available to other agencies, the price point at the things they do, and then it's like working with any vendor. If you understand better what your needs are, you're going to get a better deal than if you don't understand what your needs are. And so let me go back to the storage there. 123 terabytes of storage, and then with that potentially more than doubling to 293 tera through 2021, that's a great deal of data. I mean, that's an enormous amount of data. And to just say that we're going to go through and put that out in the cloud without going through an analysis and assessment, saying what it is, what is it that should be stratified, what needs to be online, what can be nearline, what can we keep but it can be kept offline, and being able to better understand the needs of the agency, as well as to better, it makes us a better customer as well, when we can go out to folks and say, okay, well, this is the stuff that we can do for, you know, we don't care as much about this, we can put this on a Dropbox, but this stuff here we care a great, great deal about, and so this has to be high availability storage and has to be backed up, has to be maintained, has to be available all the time. So, quite frankly, we don't have enough insight into what our own needs are, you know.
Yes.
So my background is, we run web companies, mm-hmm. and not this type of work, but we certainly have a huge need for data storage, managing databases. We used to use Easy Street when they had Easy Street years ago, and made a switch to a different type of server format because we were able to significantly reduce our costs by more than like 50%. So the volume doesn't overwhelm me, because I think that there are places out there that you could do that. I guess the question I have is going back to, is it that you actually, you know, I get redundancy and being able to pull data back up, but do you really need internal people managing servers, is when there are folks who just, that's their full-time profession, they're always online, like our servers never go down, because we also need to be up 24/7. So I'm just, you know, how much effort is really going into doing that full life cycle cost analysis mm-hmm. to get to that, or is that, I mean, are you telling us you're sort of still in that process?
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, it's a variety of answers. So when it comes specifically to Dogami, there aren't dedicated people for Dogami.
Okay.
When it comes to the state overall, we do the Hep C database. That's not really something we'd want to have out in the, you know, that has to have high security. We have Oregon State Police systems that go through our data center. Those aren't things that we would want to have out in the wild and what have you. We have a lot of systems that are many systems that have a lot of sensitive data, that have a lot of data, a lot of services that are that people depend upon us very much for. And so because of those services, we are still in the process of assessing what it is that, you know, we've had. So ETS has been under my authority for just coming up on a year now. And we haven't gone through as much of the assessment as we need to. One of the things that the Legislative Fiscal Office has asked us to do is to perform an assessment and go through and figure out where we are in time and space. That report is going to be due before the next legislative session, and we're hoping to have that to y'all by December. But insofar, so we've got two different conversations going on. On the one hand, with Dogami, and with the structure they're doing, there's no doubt there's resources that the state data center has that could be made available today for Dogami and very quickly address some of those issues that they're having to live with. On the other hand, there's a longer-term question that you're asking, well, what is it the state really needs to be in the business to do? You know, as an example, one of the things that we do is we have a lot of servers that are 2004 Windows operating system to or Windows Server 2004. It's very expensive. It's very difficult to find anyone out there in the cloud that even wants to support or would host you on 2004. These are core systems to corrections. We are the provider in many cases of last resort to agencies because it's too expensive. They don't have the money to upgrade. There's not an upgrade for whatever systems they have. So we're kind of stuck in a funny sort of place where, on the one hand, we're trying to provide the very most bleeding-edge technologies, and at the same time, we're having to support systems that should have been that
legacy,
that are very old but provide critical needs to organizations that we have to support, we have to continue to maintain. So we're trying to go through our business case and identify or articulate clearly what it is the state data center should be doing. Should we be that provider of last resort? If we're not, who's going to be? And then on the other hand, looking forward, how are we going to integrate? How are we going to have what we call a technology reference model, a technology architecture, and with which vendors and with which agreements, such that we can advantage ourselves of those things that are out there without having to compromise we can be more nimble. That's really what we're ultimately trying to do, ma'am. So, long answer to a short question.
Well, I guess my follow-up, you know, is I have to be honest, for whatever reason, people from ETS find my office with a lot of complaints about ETS. And that's, I do have some concerns about, as we're saying, talking about having, you know, kind of these micro conversations of we're just going to do something for Dogami or we're just going to do something for DHS or whatever. And we had another software program, the Forest software people came in or the Forest Department came in and, you know, they needed a software need. And I feel like a lot of these conversations are happening in isolation rather than bigger systems thinking about software and servers and data management. And we certainly see that even in our own, you know, Secretary of State's office has been hacked. I mean, we've seen like a lot of data problems overall. And so I am a little concerned that these conversations are happening on they feel to us, at least to me as a legislator, that they're happening on little islands without sort of looking at longer life cycle cost benefit analysis. And from some of the concerns I hear from ETS employees that, you know, they feel a little bit running ragged on some of these projects without a lot of direction. And I know you haven't been there very long, so a lot of those were previous to you being there. conversations that I've had with employees, but no less than a dozen I've talked to maybe in the last 2-3 years, mm-hmm. who are really frustrated with what's happening in that department, and feeling like we're not getting the best sort of bang for our buck on data and servers and software and et cetera. And I don't know how we rectify that, but I do want to point that out as we're looking at another project in isolation of bigger systems thinking on state data projects.
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, thank you for the observation. I agree. We have had these discussions out of context. You may not be aware, my first assignment here coming to the state 2 years ago I was put in charge of the Cover Oregon IT project. And I don't need to elaborate much more about that. One of the early things that I had done is establish a unified systems development life cycle. You may be familiar with the stage gate process that the LFO and my office developed, and now all IT projects go through a standard process for how they go from cradle to go live. That was something that was lacking before we got here. There are other places where in a federated, one of the reasons we have these discussions in isolation is because we are a federated IT world here in the state of Oregon. We don't have a unified IT shop. That was different than my previous experience in Oklahoma. So we've got, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So, that's part of what we do here.
Thank you. I want to pay attention to time. We have another bill yet to hear. But I want to make certain that Representative Parrish's questions are answered. Any other questions?
No, I think that's fine for now, but thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or discussion? Okay, then I'm going to go ahead. And do I need to gavel out that we accept the...
Well, let me do a recommendation.
Okay, let's do recommendations. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging and receive the report with the understanding that the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries will do the following. Regularly provide progress status reports to the Office of the State Chief Information Officer, Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office, and LFO. Partner with OSCIO to jointly develop and present a tactical IT remediation plan to the Emergency Board and the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology during the May 2016 legislative days, and that should include any requests for additional resources to carry out that remediation plan. And then finally, develop and present a plan and supporting budget requests to the OSCIO, the governor, and the legislature for implementing the report's recommendations as part of the 2017-19 biannual budget development process in the 2017 session.
Thank you. And do we?
Chair, I would so move the LFO report.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hansel, we move to accept the report from the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries IT assessment report in closing that work session. Thank you so much. And then we are... I need a carrier to full. Thank you, Senator Hansel. And then, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to stand at ease for a moment, and I will be back shortly. Now we are back. We're going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1587. And I'm going to have LFO introduce the bill, please, Michelle. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senate Bill 1587 comes to you from Senate Workforce. It enables expenditures from the Wage Security Fund for enforcement of wage and hour laws. It requires certain information to be printed on pay stubs and provided to employees, and you have an A6 amendment that is recommended by the Legislative Fiscal Office that will increase other funds expenditure limitation by $325,954 to support 3 permanent full-time positions, 1.89 FTE within the wage and hour division to investigate and enforce claims of underpaid and unpaid wages. So.
Okay, thank you. And we have Senator Dembrough here and some others to testify. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Taylor. And yes, I'm sure you never expected to get this bill here to this committee. But, when you're a senator, the committee comes to you. As opposed to when you're a representative, you go to the committee. Now, this is This was a surprise to us all, and I think just a function of timing that the schedule for this committee and the workload for this committee allowed for this bill to be heard here. And just to reiterate that Senate Bill 1587 comes from the Workforce and General Government Committee on the Senate side and is here mainly because of the issue that Michelle mentioned having to do with the addition of three new enforcement compliance specialists in Boley, which will be funded through the Wage Security Fund. Let me just back up and give you a very quick overview of this. The purpose of this bill is to deal with the problem of what's often called wage theft when you have bad employers who don't properly pay their employees what they're due or on time. Everyone, I think, believes that that should not be tolerated, and we need to try to root out that problem whenever we can and get the bad actors to become good actors or not be in business, because it's not fair to the entire industry when you have people like that working. The challenge when you're doing something like trying to come to grips with wage theft is you want to make sure that you really are getting at the bad actors and not just creating a lot of unnecessary heartache for good actors. That is what we're trying to do here in Senate Bill 1587. It's the product of lots and lots of work grouping, lots of time spent with Betsy Earls from AOI and other partners to get this bill to a place where it really will, I think, do a lot of good. What it does is it's really appropriate, I think, for the short session in that it takes pieces from bills that were in the queue last session, but in part for timing reasons, in part for just challenges with the wording, et cetera, didn't make it through, and brought together into this bill. Trying to get the problems worked out. And I think we have successfully done that to the point that it is supported by all of our industry partners at this point. So just very quickly, what it does in Section 1, it makes sure that the employee's pay stub has the necessary information so that the worker knows, first of all, who their employer is and where they're located. And that may seem self-evident that it should. But in fact, we have seen many cases in which the employer turns out to be a kind of fly-by-night operation and the employee doesn't really know who he or she is working for. We wanted to clarify, you know, make sure that all the necessary information was on the pay stub. I think we have done that here. It also, in Section 2, it guarantees workers access to their time and pay records. If they make a request to their employer to see their time and pay records, the employer is expected to provide them within 45 days. That is, I think, parallel to existing law with respect to other personnel records. The third section, and this is the crux of the matter from the Ways and Means perspective, is so I think everyone agrees that Boley does very important work. But Boley is underfunded. And Boley is underfunded to the point that it's very difficult for them to do spot checks or, you know, to do any kind of preventative work that will prevent wage theft. In fact, they largely can only respond to multiple complaints from a single employer. There was an attempt last year through House Bill 2921 to look at the Wage Security Fund, which is a fund that industry pays into to cover cases in which an employer goes out of business and doesn't have the ability, the worker doesn't have the ability to recoup their wages. This is a fund that has it has been in existence for quite a while, has a very solid track record. And among our conversations with industry, there was interest in using some of that fund, while not, you know, not so much that it would in any way compromise the integrity of the fund, but to use some of that fund to hopefully ward off instances of bad action, and to provide the positions in wage enforcement compliance that were needed. House Bill 2921 last year ran into problems because ultimately it was way too vague and not, really wasn't clear on how many positions or what they would be used for, et cetera. And so it didn't move forward at the end of the day. We have gone in and really tightened it up in terms of what these, how many positions we're talking about, in this case three, what they would be used for, in this case wage enforcement, to make it in a form that everyone would feel comfortable with, including our rigorous LFO analysts. So that is Section 3. Section 4 has to do with violations of prevailing wage. Towards the end of the session last year, we had Senate Bill 963 that Senator Johnson sponsored to deal with some really egregious cases of prevailing wage violations, where people were, really committing what most of us would consider crimes. And so there was a desire to really send out a strong message that these kinds of behaviors were not tolerable, and we so Senate Bill 963 made certain violations Class C felonies. It passed in the Senate, but it was right at the end of the session, and it didn't move forward in the House. So that's been reintegrated into this overall package. Section 5, just the operative dates, and Section 6, an emergency clause. And that emergency clause has actually been modified in amendments that Betsy will tell you about that have it. The emergency clause now only applies to the new positions, which are needed immediately. But the other things, which may take some time for industry to adjust to, there is no emergency clause on those. So with that, you have Senate Bill 1587. I urge your aye vote. It's time. I think it has broad support. And with that, I'll turn it over to Betsy.
Thank you, Senator Dembro. We have three people who have signed up to testify, and I want to make certain we have time for questions from members of the committee, and we are short on time. Do you have a question for Senator Dembro,
Mr. I do. You said it's supported by all the industrial partners. Could you list those for me? You said AOI.
Yeah.
Who else?
And you have a bill brief in your, on OLIS. AOI, the Trucking Association, the Home Builders, and AGC. And Chambers of Commerce. Those who are on this list were all part of the work groups that we had at one time or another to move this bill forward to deal with this problem.
Okay. Any other questions for Senator Dembro at this time? Then let's go ahead and hear from Betsy Earls, and then again John Mullis and Dave Tischel is also. Those three are signed up to testify. So,
thank you. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I'm appearing before you today in support of the modified Senate Bill 1587. As Senator Dembro has mentioned, the bill has been something that we've worked on for quite a long time. I think both proponents and opponents of the original wage theft bill last session and then again this session all agreed, honestly, on one thing, that wage theft is a problem that none of us want in this state. Employees, for the obvious reasons, and employers, because it makes the rest of our employers and, you know, the majority of employers that are acting in good faith look very bad. So I think there was some fundamental disagreement in the beginning about how to address the problem. And our position from the industry standpoint was that people that are not, that are engaging in wage theft, are not obeying the law right now. And no matter how many more laws we impose around the idea of wage theft or the problem, they're probably not going to start obeying those just because they're new. So what industry came up with as a group was the idea of providing for more enforcement of the wage theft laws that we have right now. Because although I don't know if wage theft, I honestly don't know if wage theft is a widespread problem, we do know that the people that engaged in it, that do engage in it, are fairly entrenched, you know, a, kind of a hardcore group of people that, that do it over and over. So our preference, again, from the industry standpoint, was to provide more resources for enforcement for BOLI. And we felt like, you know, part of the problem was that it would help if the employer community helped to police itself to some extent. And so we offered to dedicate some resources from the Wage Security Fund to that end and see if we can make some impact on the problem as it stands right now. We made several adjustments to the first bill in the amendments that you have before you. Actually, in the bill you had, the base bill, and then also in the amendments, we made a few tweaks. I think probably the most important tweak that you see before you is that we have an effective date of for the wage enforcement specialist piece beginning right away. The rest of the bill that has to do with adjustments that employers need to make to pay stub software and systems, the rest of it does not take effect until the end of this year or the normal effective date for a bill. We wanted employers to have time to adjust to those extra pieces, but we wanted to start the wage theft piece as soon as we could. So I'm happy to answer questions, but I think you've heard probably a fair amount of detail already.
Okay, thank you. Betsy, Senator Hansel?
How did the figure of three employees, three wage specialists come to be? Why three? Why not one? Why not?
Honestly, it wasn't. It wasn't a scientific process. I believe BOLI has seven right now.
Yeah, there are seven now. We felt that that was a number that, you know, could really make a difference in the key industries where we find wage theft. And it was an acceptable number within the cost parameters that we were looking at.
But no analysis if the problem dictated three? It was just a number that we picked out of the air because it sounded good?
No. I mean, I think that we could have, we need more, frankly. But we didn't feel comfortable funding more than three just for the fiscal comfort.
I guess my follow-up question, how do you know you need more? I'm trying to figure out what the analysis was to get to what we are being presented with.
Well, you know, the question was to be able to do what we wanted to do, which is, you know, to allow people to do this work in various parts of the state and to be able to do preventative kinds of work, you know, spot checks, those sorts of things. Ideally, I mean, I asked, you know, what would it take for you to be able to respond to a single complaint? And that was the number that we were given.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. I've got a couple of questions, if you'll indulge.
1 second, Representative Parrish. I just want to make certain we have John Mullis and Dave Tischer here, and we have a limited amount of time, unfortunately.
Well,
so we do you want to wait for the other panel folks to speak?
It's sort of along the lines of what Senator Hansel asked about the cost and how you came to this number. I mean, fully loaded, these positions are roughly almost $90,000 a year. And if you're saying that we need to go out and spot check people into companies that have not actually, where there's been no complaints, I'm assuming we're just saying we're going to go in. When you say spot check, can you explain to me what that is? I mean, you just show up at my company to check my books? Or
there was based on a complaint or what's a spot check? Because I'm not really interested personally in saying we're just going to randomly show up in people's businesses and ask them to look at their payroll when there's been no even hint of an offense that, and we're going to spend $500,000 in the next biennium going into a budget crisis to actually pay for that.
Yeah. Madam Chair, you know, I think Boley, you know, is here. They can probably explain that. You know, there are certain industries and certain situations, certain, you know, subcategories of industries. You know, for example, you know, within the construction industry, I think we all know that day labor kinds of situations are real problems. And, you know, so we would expect you know, a lot of activity in that arena. Beyond that, I mean, I would have you ask Boley. I certainly, you know, I don't believe that they have any intention, nor would they have the capacity, even within these, you know, these positions, nor any desire to just go in willy-nilly. They're going to follow leads, and they are, you know, going to, as I say, go after those who maybe have violated before or, you know, where there's a high likelihood that they're going to find problems.
A follow-up?
Yes, a follow-up.
So if we're basing that, though, on if they violated before and now we're saying, well, once you made one violation, I mean, like Chipotle just made people sick with food poisoning, but I expect that they clean that up and we're not sending the, you know, after that first round of cleanup, we don't just randomly send the health department there over and over and over again because they had an instance of food poisoning, right? So, I mean, I want to wrap my hands around when you say spot check.
Yeah, I would expect, Madam Chair, I would expect higher observation of Chipotle for a period of time, right, until, you know, it's clear that everything is going okay there.
But that should be in the normal part of a violation. I would expect that there's going to be some spot check. But what I'm hearing you say is, well, if you've offended it before, that's likely for me to need to send somebody in again later on. That doesn't make me comfortable. It really takes a due process piece out of, you know, anybody who's operating a business and otherwise is walking about their day sort of lawfully going about their day. We're now making assumption because you offended once that that's going to happen again. And that doesn't make me feel real comfortable, just it's philosophically.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
That you're not comfortable, but you know, I will say that this, you know, we worked on this with people from industry. Everyone, you know, as I think Ms. Earls mentioned, you know, believes that we need better enforcement, more enforcement, and this seemed the best route to get there.
Okay, thank you, Senator Deborah. Representative Parrish, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and so maybe what we can do here is we'll have Mr. Mullis and Mr. Tischel, yes, speak, maybe keeping their testimony, since I see they're for the bill, to a minute or so, and then we can perhaps have someone from Boley here that can come up and answer your question. How does that sound, Representative Parrish? Okay, just in the interest of time so that everyone doesn't start fleeing, and then we can't vote on the bill, so... Nice to see you, Mr. Mullis, as always.
Good morning, Co-Chair Taylor, members of the committee. My name is John Mullis. I represent the Oregon Building Trades, and I'll be very brief, and I'll limit my remarks to Section 4 of the bill, which, as Senator Dembro explained, came out of the bill from last session. And this was a bill that Dan Harmon, General Counsel for Hoffman Construction, came up with. He's a large general contractor in Portland. They had three instances in a couple of years where they had final cleaning contractors that were literally stealing from their workers. This isn't misclassification where you list a bricklayer as a laborer to try and save a couple bucks or maybe miss a couple hours. And the most egregious story of the one, and this was came out in Senator Dembro's committee, was one of the firms would give their employees their paychecks, march them all down to an ATM, have them cash their checks, and give half the money back. So unfortunately, you know, I will say the overwhelming majority of employers are honest people, But there are these few bad actors that are out there, and we need this tool, I believe, to go after them. And if I can take 1 second to speak to Representative Parrish's question, the most recent edition of the Northwest Labor Press, and I'll find a copy and drop it by your office tomorrow, is a story about a hotel remodel at a hotel that you'd all recognize off of 217, where they're redoing the tile and the carpet. And people came in from out of town. They're hungry from, they have no work in their home area, worked for several weeks, kept saying, we'll pay you next week, next week. The employer vanished, and now these people have been here for 4 or 5 weeks, have no money, and I would hope that Boley, when they hear about this, would be able to send an investigator out today or tomorrow, not in a week or two. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Mullis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Tischer. I represent Labor's Local 737. We're 2,500 construction workers, state of Oregon. I've been doing this for 16 years, and over those 16 years, I've came across a couple of handfuls of really bad actors. The record I saw was 5 companies, 7 violations, and nobody ever spent a day in jail. And it was well over $250,000 this person before the debarment process and the bully process continued. My hope for this bill and my belief is, with a criminal element in 879's toolkit, I think that they can either both put these people out of business for good and deter some of these people that are out there. The consequence of a growing economy is more players in the field, and unfortunately that it's going to bring more bad actors into the arena, because that's just how it works. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for either of our panelists? And then thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Coming today.
All right.
And then who from Boley is Paloma? Okay, I wasn't sure if you wanted to. Hello, Paloma.
Good morning, Co-Chair Taylor. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Thank you so much. Before you get going, just again, in the interest of time, so there was a specific question that I believe you wanted answered.
Yeah,
do you want to restate the question?
Yeah, I will restate. Thank you. Okay. So, Paloma, you know, I heard Senator DeDembro say that these funds would be used to hire people to go spot check somebody's business. And I want to understand what that means, because ultimately I would expect, in the case of you had somebody who's an offender and you went in and you you know, did your due diligence and whatever that normal course of follow-up is, after somebody has cleaned up a problem, going in and spot checking and just sort of randomly showing up and saying, you know, surprise, we're here, I'm uncomfortable with that. So can you explain how Foley intends these positions to be used? And then the other follow-up question is, we do have a budget issue coming up in 17-19. We know that we've got some large budget holes. This is $500,000 of new appropriation to increase FTE. If there is an economic downturn, how does Foley intend to manage, you know, some of these types of, you're taking on some additional FTE. What happens if suddenly money doesn't manifest in the next session to pay for this? How do you solve that problem?
Co-Chair Taylor, Representative Parrish, when we were discussing how we would use these positions, there was an analysis about how USDOL every year announces what their enforcement plan is going to be. We will do something similar where we will have a focus for these three positions on what we're going to be looking at. I will tell you that the spot check, the idea of going back and doing spot checks after somebody's violated, that's often a very traditional part of how an enforcement action works. Like, that's how the business remedies what the violation has been. That's pretty common. What we would do is we would focus on the areas where either we've identified there are significant problems, where there is a pattern of violations, where we've received information from other contractors, other businesses, employers, employees, that there are violations. You know, three people is not going to be enough to just start knocking randomly on anybody's door. We're going to have sort of our standard, but the plan and the discussion that we've had with industry is, you know, every year we'll develop a plan, announce what that plan is, and use these additional positions for that. On the funding question, the Wage Security Fund is sort of, it's limited. It's not general fund money. Currently, it can only be used for administrative costs and for payouts. And each employee is limited in how much of a payout they can collect. Traditionally, we have not paid out enough out of that wage security fund to limit the ability of the resources available in the wage security fund. So the wage security fund has more money in it than we have used.
How much does that have in it right now?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Alifa. Okay, currently BOLI is estimating that the wage security fund by the end of the 15-17 biennium will have an estimated balance of $8.3 million. Once per biennium, this fund is basically funded by a transfer of 0.03% of unemployment insurance taxes that is transferred over to the Bureau of Labor and Industries for the purpose of final wage payouts.
So the follow-up to that would be, at $500,000 a biennium, how fast does that fund get depleted, and what would be the ask to employers to be able to backfill that? Because that's a pretty hefty lift on $8 million.
Co-chairs, Representative Parrish, traditionally the payments out have vacillated between $1.2 million and a high of $1.8 million, which was in the 2007-09 biennium. And again, with the balance, and the transfers in have been about, this last biennium, it's estimated to be $4.6 million. So given that, it's likely to take quite a while for a level of depletion that multiple biennia.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And members, my apologies. This happens at the end of session. As Senator Dembrough noted, the reason this bill came to this sub was simply because the other sub's agendas were full, and we have a deadline set by the Senate President and the Speaker of the House to have our final full Ways and Means on Thursday, late afternoon. So the request from Senator Devlin and myself is to vote on this bill, to move it to the full. LFO has information on this bill and can provide it to members. Members who are not comfortable with the bill, of course, can vote no. But we really do need to vote on the bill today, and I appreciate your consideration.
Okay, thank you, Representative Buckley. So I think we will go ahead. Thank you so much, Paloma, for coming up and answering questions. So we have a dash A6 amendment. Yes, Senator Hansen.
I need to appreciate Mr. Co-Chair, or big...
Whoever I am.
Whatever you are.
Yeah.
I just, the process, we're a natural resource committee. We have not been lobbying on this. We have no pre-arrangement of this, and we're asking to make a major decision to move it forward, and I'm listening to this. I don't have a lot of confidence in the history of BOLI, period. Mm-hmm. And for us, without any of the background, to pass a fairly significant bill to increase their police force activity, and when I don't think they've used it very well in the past on some issues, I told Senator Devlin I'd be in favor of it, but without that background and the way the procedure of this whole thing, I'm having trouble.
I can go get him, Senator.
Okay.
Okay.
For
we
those
will
reasons.
Go ahead and stand at ease for a moment. Senate Bill 1587, and we have a dash A6 amendment. If you could please make a motion to move that.
Move the dash 6
A6
amendment.
Thank you. We have a motion to move the dash A6 amendment to discussion to Senate Bill 1587. Sorry. And is there any discussion, any objection to the amendment? Please. Yes.
Now, but I may change when it goes to the floor. I'm going to do some more research.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hack. So we have, do we need to take a roll, or just you're objecting now to the dash A6 amendment?
Actually, I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine.
I'm objecting.
Representative Parrish objects to the dash A6. Anybody else object to the amendment? Okay. Then we go ahead and we pass the dash 6 amendment for Senate Bill 1587. Now we need a final motion to move Senate Bill 1.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
On do it official. Move, I could just say so moved, but move SB 1507 to the full Committee on Ways and Means as amended.
Okay, and so I have a motion to move Senate Bill 1587 to the full Committee on Ways and Means as amended. Discussion, objection? Representative Parrish objects. Representative Senator Hansel objects. Any other discussion? So passed, Senate Bill 1587. So we need a carrier to the full.
He's not on the full.
I can do it.
Why don't you? Because it'll be the
be on Thursday, right?
It'll be on Thursday, yeah, so you should probably do
okay,
it.
Okay, and I will happily carry this to the floor. And would you, Senator Tambro, I assume would like to carry it,
carry it
to the Senate. Okay, then we are going to go ahead and close the hearing today on Subcommittee on Natural Resources. First we're going to close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1587. And then we are going to close the meeting on Joint Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Thank you.